Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, we are into April, and we are starting out with Reading with Rogues is next week.
Yep.
This is our new sort of bi-monthly Reading with Rogues graphic novel club. So
it's a comic extravaganza.
That's right. So come out and talk comics with us. The focus is going to be on the last month's book, which is Descender.
Yep.
And this month's book, which is the classic Dark Knight Returns, which you can get right now for 15% off, or if you're a Rogue Card member, 25% off.
Yep. I'm going to read that this week, and since I probably haven't read it in 10 or 15 years, I'll be anxious to talk about that one.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to going back to it, too.
I love Descender. I'll be curious to see if Dark Knight holds up for me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading that, too. Also, if anybody has seen the animated feature or wants to, it's on HBO now. I watched it on sort of a whim and kind of dug it, so we'll probably talk about that, too.
It's a two-parter, right?
It's a two-parter, yeah. And I was pretty happy with, so I'm probably going to bring some discussion about that too.
Yep.
Dave was talking about doing some sort of a discussion guide. I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
You know what? I was originally going to like have something that people would take home with them, but I think instead what I want to do maybe is have like a little have that as a little questionnaire thing.
Yeah.
So like as we'll go around, I'll say like, all right, well let's talk about the art, or what did you think was, you know, because Batman's got like a ton of cool lines in there. It's like,
yep.
What's your favorite cool Batman scene in there?
Yep.
Everybody can kind of throw out their scene, and so we'll kind of do it more at the gathering itself.
Okay, all right. The end of this month, April 30th, is International Tabletop Day. You can see our updated schedule. We've got the schedule locked in. We know what the prizes are going to be for the most part. It's a good lineup this year. It's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be running from about 12:30 till almost close that day. We're going to do a big super fight tournament to close it out. And we are going to be, if you look every couple of days on Facebook, we'll be doing posts about the games that we're featuring. So every couple of days, go to Facebook. You'll see we've got a list of what the game is. Link to the official page, so you can go look it up, and a video of how to play, whether it's the tabletop video, which a couple of them have, or a variety of other how-to-play videos I found.
Nice.
So yeah, we'll be doing a lot of feature of that throughout the month. And we are not doing Gaming with Rogues this month because we're doing International Tabletop Day.
Right.
But that will be
that should be enough gaming to satisfy anybody.
That's right. But that will be back in May. And importantly, we do still have a pick for our members. So if you are a Rogue Card member, this month you get 10% off Boss Monster, which is one of the games we'll be featuring at Tabletop Day.
And a fairly popular game just in its own right.
Yep. Then on May 7th, we will have Free Comic Book Day. And pretty soon here, we're going to be getting our free comics, I'm sure, to take a look through and give people our rundown of it.
Man, I'm excited because the list looks fantastic.
It's a great list this year, and it's always a good time. So spread the word on Free Comic Book Day. Get people out. We love to have a big line and be people coming all day. So
yep.
Also, Ladies Night is going to be rescheduled till May, but hopefully for a cool reason.
Right,
so we
right.
will have more info on that soon. All right, moving on to the news. And I want to start with Nick posted something in our discussion thread that we had going about podcast topics. Robin Wright has joined the Blade Runner sequel.
Yeah.
By the way, just real quick, do we know when that's coming out? Like, is this generic?
Next year, right?
I thought it was 2017, maybe early 2018.
Yeah, I think so, too. So, the Blade Runner sequel, I feel like I want to be the cynic on this one, just like I was with Batman versus Rob versus Superman versus Robin versus Time Warner versus Avengers.
Predator.
Versus Predator Man. Versus Mindhunter.
Yes.
I can see that.
But as I think about it, my question has always been, when was the last good movie Harrison Ford was in? And the answer is now Force Awakens. And when was the last time Ridley Scott made a good movie? And the answer is now The Martian.
Yeah.
So maybe there's reason for hope?
Yep. The shadow of Prometheus looms over all.
Yes, yes. Looms over everything we've built here and threatens to destroy.
Yeah, not only Robin Wright has joined the cast, but also Dave Bautista.
Yep.
Is that Drax?
It's Drax.
Yeah, it's Drax.
He's got to be like the Roy Batty, right? Combat replicant.
Man, he's really sort of made a name for himself in the sense of joining a bunch of. When he was in the last Bond, he was in.
He was in Spy.
Wasn't he?
No, he wasn't in Spy.
Oh, was he in Bond? And that's what I'm thinking. Yeah
he was in Bond.
Was he the big henchman in
Bond? Yeah,
he had sort of like the car chase,
brutal fight in the car train.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Is he anything more than a strong man?
He's solid. I mean, he was good as Drax.
Right, right.
He was good in Bond.
I just wondered, he hasn't had any roles that have not been that, though.
That's
right?
True, yeah.
Some sort of version of,
but
like,
he has but yeah, I think he's, you know, done acting classes. He says he's wanted to sort of hone his craft a little bit, so...
He's got more chops than your average wrestler.
Can he become...
That's true.
The question is, can he follow in the footsteps of The Rock? Who has some breadth, but also made all kinds of terrible career choices and did some bad moves.
Are you saying it'd be good if he followed in the path of The Rock, or bad if he followed in the path
I guess
of the
I'd
Rock?
Say for him it'd be good.
Okay.
And made a name for himself. I mean, he's a very entertaining
actor. I just wondered, like, can he do anything other than throw people through walls?
I actually could see Batista being up in that level of The Rock. He's got some charisma.
There you go.
Yeah. But this is a sequel, right? It's not a prequel or a remake or anything like that.
From my understanding, the Blade Runner is a sequel.
They're not going to tie it to the Aliens universe, are they?
Oh my god, that'd be horrible.
Because I thought there was, like, some rumor about that once upon a time.
There
and
was.
And I thought it was, like, a somewhat serious
You know,
one.
It would make a certain amount of sense that the replicants were the forerunners of the androids, and that's why everybody's so scared of them.
Right, right. Like, what do you call it, we have the early Weyland Yutani Corporation rising.
But here's the thing: I don't want that.
Yeah, I don't want it.
I don't want it, but it's not a deal breaker for me.
No, it's not a deal breaker, but it's one of those things of. It's one of the few times where I'm like, I don't need to connect it. I don't need to see this large.
Because you know what that means? We could finally get a Replicants versus Predator comic, and then we'll take off.
You know what's funny?
What about Replicants versus Predator versus Aliens?
I actually, all those universes, all that stuff is in my mind is such a part of my childhood, or at least my adolescenthood, that I love the idea of, say, a Blade Runner comic that leads into the Terminator, ties into the Terminator. Sort of more fanish, non-canon kind of thing.
Right.
Like, I love the idea of a Blade Runner versus Terminator story. I could see those worlds colliding.
I could potentially enjoy such a thing.
But I don't want it to be canon.
I don't want it to be canon.
Yeah. That's the big thing. But it's not a deal breaker for me. If they decide to do it, as long as they do it well, I'll be okay with it.
I think I'm probably, Randy, more in your what you thought you would be, the cynical area of Blade Runner. I cannot imagine it coming off.
The this is gonna suck mode? Yeah.
Yeah. It, I'd be open to being surprised. I like The Martian quite a bit, too. But I feel like the trend is when Ridley Scott revisits his own property, you get Prometheus.
That's true.
On the other hand, it's a trend of one right now. I can't truly call it a trend.
The thing about Prometheus is, so much about Prometheus should have worked. Ridley Scott's a good director. Damon Lindelof, for all that he's written some really awful stuff, also has been doing some great stuff on HBO.
You had
Fassbender, you had who's the lead? Was it Mara Rooney? No.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, and
I think that one
all the parts were there.
I think that one came down to the script. I think he.
You blame Lindelof?
I blame Lindelof.
But Lindelof can do good TV. I mean, what happened?
But you know, Lost, for all that I enjoyed, Lost also had some. Lots of frustrations and like WTF sort of.
I'm not even talking about Lost. I'm talking about his HBO show The Leftovers, which I outright love.
I've not seen The Leftovers.
Here's another thing about Ridley Scott and Blade Runner itself is that he has not ever been able to sort of stop toying with that.
Yeah.
Because he's
it's like George Lucas.
He's released like six different versions.
That's right.
Of
that's right.
It's like he can't get his mind away from it, and he has to tinker.
Well,
and
it is the movie that made him. Yeah. And it is one of the most discussed sci-fi movies of all time.
Yeah.
Probably like, there's 2001 and probably then Blade Runner.
Yeah. So I'm sure we've discussed this, but Blade Runner, do you like narration, non-narration?
I lean non-narration.
I probably lean non-narration, but I've never had the hatred for it that some people have.
I found it a little off-putting.
Oh, I love the narration. I know that they didn't, I know that it was not Ridley Scott's choice.
Right,
I know
that
Harrison Ford famously came in and sort of read it in sort of a dead voice and trying to sort of sabotage it, which actually worked perfectly.
Yeah, we talked about, like, that fits a noir, that's a noir kind of dead-to-the-world detective.
Yeah.
And it also fits his character in a way. And I will say this, there are times when I will, like, miss something that was in the narration because it is hardly, you know, the what we would think of nowadays as, like, spoon-feeding the audience.
Yeah.
It built the world up a little bit more, and every once in a while, it kind of, it did tell you a little bit, like, here's what you should be thinking about this scene.
Yeah.
That was a little heavy-handed, but it wasn't that... all that crass.
You know what? Maybe he should go into a director's cut where he takes out some but not all the narrations.
Harrison Ford re-records it in old man voice. How about this, Randy? Add narration to Prometheus.
Yes.
Maybe it'll fix it.
Add the narration from Blade Runner. Just nonsensically.
It might work.
All right.
Next topic.
Staying in movie news. They have cast the New Mutants, except that they haven't.
Right.
So...
Well, we thought that, you know... we thought they had.
Yeah,
was this April Fool's thing?
No, this is... I think this was
just internet trying to get ahead of
I think stuff. This was a flyer. I think that the director is talking to people, and either the news got out early, or they deliberately leaked it to see if they could get some... what the interest, what the reaction was.
Yeah, I don't remember what the actual thing originally said, like, you know, that an executive said this. I think it was one of those... It was one of those things. It was either bad information or it was indeed a controlled leak.
So what we heard was that Maisie Williams from Game of Thrones was going to be Wolfsbane, and that Anya Taylor-Joy, who was in The Witch, was going to be Magic.
I haven't seen The Witch, but I watched the trailer, and I was like, I could definitely see her as Magic.
And then perfect. There was a third. I can't remember who the third person was. I know that... the third was Storm. They said that Storm from X-Men Apocalypse is going to be one of the New Mutants.
Okay.
Which makes sense in this continuity, and that Storm is going to be a young mutant.
I could sort of see it.
However, Fox basically came out and completely denied it.
Right. Now, sometimes things get denied that still turn out to be true, right?
Yes. Like, for example, that Supergirl Flash crossover that was never happening.
Right. This
become the new sort of go-to answer for Hollywood at this point.
Yeah,
this seemed like good casting. Like Maisie Williams, I was like, if she could throw on a Scottish accent and being British, I figured she probably could.
Yep.
We know she's a good actress. She's right the age for Wolfbane.
I was gonna say, truthfully, if you're mining for young actors, Game of Thrones is perfect.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, that's where they got their Jean Grey.
Yeah. Sansa is Jean Grey.
Yeah, I would love for that to be true.
Now, here's my thing. I am hoping that this casting, at least the characters, are the ones that they'll be using, and I don't know if that's the case, because there was a time in the early 80s when there was only one X-Men title, and it had only ever been one X-Men title, and the second one that they made was called New Mutants, and I'm betting a lot of people listening to this were not there for that.
Nope.
Probably within, like, what, 4 or 5 years, they would do X-Factor, and then that would kind of get the ball rolling on, you know, lots of X-Men titles.
I think there's one discrepancy in the team lineup.
Yeah?
Because I know Cannonball is mentioned in there, and I know Cannonball is actually supposed to be part of the X-Force movie that they're trying to get together as well.
Well, that doesn't mean they won't do it in New Mutants, too.
Right.
He could be the kind of earnest farm boy in this one, and then... dark things happen to him or whatever, and we see, oh, wow, he's changed in that movie.
Or he goes over to X-Force, like, just like he did in the comics.
Yeah. Did he join X-Force?
Oh, yeah. He was a member of main, he was one of the, he was the leader of X-Force for
a
while.
He was there in that 90s Liefeld... Yep.
The abomination that gave birth to the abomination that is Deadpool.
Yes.
I guess he'd have dropped that.
Never gonna happen.
You can't kill him.
I see that
there's
happening.
No way.
I want to go to an alternate universe that never had a Deadpool.
Yeah.
It's a utopia.
What if you went to an alternate universe that never had a Deadpool and it has the Blade Runner narration over
Prometheus? You know, if there are infinite universes means
yes.
It has to exist.
Yes, that's right. There's also a world where the Blade Runner dialogue is in Prometheus, but there's also a Deadpool. There's also a world in which the Blade Runner dialogue is over the Deadpool movie.
If there are infinite universes, does that also mean that in one of those universes, my lower torso could be tank treads?
You know what's horrible, Dave? If there are infinite universes, there is a universe right now where this podcast is happening, and Nick is vociferously arguing about how Deadpool sucks, and you and I are strongly arguing for him. There are universes where you and I love Deadpool.
This just got all Neil deGrasse Tyson in here. What were we talking about? New Mutants, right? So the New Mutants of that era were sort of a multinational team, not unlike the original. The original X-Men, the X-Men of that everybody knows from that was considered the new X-Men at the time.
Right.
Wolverine, Storm, Colossus, Cyclops, all that stuff. I really like those early characters. I wouldn't have ever particularly expected that the movie would reflect them. They do a lot of mixing and matching.
I wouldn't have thought it either, but it sounds like... Unless this was all completely made up.
Right, if the whole thing is completely made up, and maybe it was, then that would be too bad. I would love to see some reflection of the New Mutants as they existed in the early to mid-80s.
Agreed.
I will only watch it if Warlock is there.
I do think Warlock should be in the
movie. We were speculating about it. There's all kinds of speculation we were doing.
Because if I do not hear Self-Friend,
we were thinking Warlock would be showing up for the sequel.
Yeah, probably was that.
But anyway, All right. One last bit of movie news, sort of. Benedict Cumberbatch is currently filming Doctor Strange.
Yeah, or if you were on the internet last week, you probably saw pictures of him.
Our comic book shop dressed as
right. So he was dressed as Doctor Strange. Idris Elba's
No, it's
Chiwetel Ejiofor. Right. Is Baron Mordo. And there's some great gifs of them out jumping in costume and that kind of thing.
Right.
But Cumberbatch, wearing the costume, went in and bought Doctor Strange comics at JHU, yeah. which is a New York comic shop.
You know what's funny to me? I am quite sure that their research staff and all that had all the Doctor Strange comics they needed.
Yep, yep.
I'm sure this was just a publicity thing.
Yeah.
And I don't begrudge them, though. Nope. It's a good publicity yep. thing.
Maybe he just wanted to read comics. You don't know.
No. Nah. Yeah. They would have given him all the comics he wanted in his trailer.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a cool thing though.
It was.
He went and took some selfies with people.
Yeah,
and,
I saw a picture also with Brian Vaughn's The Oath.
Yeah,
Doctor Strange The Oath, which I'm sure Vaughn was not taken aback by that or anything. I'm sure that was a cool thing.
Yeah, no, it looks really cool, and also just not for nothing, but the Doctor Strange costume looks great.
It's a great redesign. It does.
And the Mordo costume looks great. Well,
one of the things I noticed they did is they made it look a little. It kind of has the look of like a medieval, like an alchemist or something that. So, and yet it has the bright colors that one associates with in modern times.
Yeah.
And they didn't go the route of making like battle armor or something like that. They found a way to make it work, and this is kind of something I'd always wanted them to do. I always felt that they were like kind of bad in the 90s and early 2000s, kind of cheap casting costuming choices.
Yeah.
Where they're like, oh, we can't put the X-Men in their costumes; it just won't work. It would look silly on the screen. And I was always thinking, I bet if you got creative, you could find a way to represent the variety of costumes.
I don't want to make this a DC versus Marvel thing, but I'm gonna.
Yeah.
This is what I look at, say, Batman versus Superman. Look how dark Superman's costume is.
Yeah.
And it's just like the
Doctor Strange should not be brighter than Superman.
Yeah. Just the embarrassment about your source material shows through in your work, and Marvel's never had that. Mm-hmm. They love their source material. Well, it's very clear.
Yeah. Once it became Marvel Studios, now I will say the X-Men movies are one of the things I was thinking of because they gave them the black costumes, which
worked out fine.
It worked out fine, but I think that with sort of the thinking that's come into play since Marvel started producing their own movies, I believe you could have gone with more individualized costumes.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
I think you have to look at Captain America. Captain America is the place where they could have gone dark. Like, nobody's going to buy this guy in a blue spandex suit. We're going to make him look more soldier-like.
And they did this sort of spectrum because whether or not – I mean, it was used as a joke in the film. They definitely used the spandex outfit.
But even his costume that he wore that was sort of militarized was still a Captain America uniform.
Oh, it was very much so.
And I think there's Infinite Universe theory, there are any number of places where that would not have happened, where they would have gone with more of a drab green and maybe a little nod to him having wings painted on his helmet or something.
Yeah. You know the costume he's got when he was director of S.H.I.E.L.D., right?
Yeah, yeah.
Top Cop?
Yeah, Top Cop.
Where it was kind of like an all navy costume with a little bit of that shield, like that S.H.I.E.L.D. eagle sort of on the chest. That was also right. They could have done that right from the get go.
Yeah,
that could have been the costume. It's a good design.
Yeah.
It's just not very Captain America-y.
Right.
And they didn't.
But I think once they did that costume and they saw that people were willing to go along for the ride, that opened the door. And then we could do Thor, and then we could do Vision, and then we could have all the various costumes they've done.
I will say, although it was always a little bit overly designed for the movies, that to give credit where due, Spider-Man, they went faithful straight out of the gate with the Sam Raimi movies. And so that did at least, I think probably a lot of people was like, well, Spider-Man's costume is unique. You can't replicate that with other characters.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, you can.
But it is kind of crazy every so often. We'd say this all the time, to reflect on the golden age we live in, that there is going to be a Doctor Strange movie.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to do huge business.
Yeah, November.
The casting for it is insane.
Yeah.
They don't even get, like, promising B-listers. They get A-listers.
Yeah,
yeah. You have Benedict Cumberbatch, Chiwetel
Ejiofor.
You have Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah.
And you've got...
So Mads Mikkelsen's got to be Dormammu, right?
We don't know,
who's
but
playing
we think.
Clea or...
It's Rachel McAdams.
Rachel McAdams.
Yeah. Man, it's just A-list across the board.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So, and the first look... I mean, the first look is really promising, so I am super excited. Yeah, me neither.
Civil War?
Maybe.
I mean, that would make sense.
Yeah, maybe. We may see a trailer of that soon.
God, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
All right, well, what else we got?
All right. Moving on to TV news. Speaking of, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this. Colleen Wing is going to be in the Iron Fist series.
Oh, yeah. No, what surprises you about that? Because that makes sense to me.
We live in a world where there's going to be Power Man, Iron Fist, and Nightwing restorations on TV.
Right, the assumption is usually on these things is like, well, they'll take Iron Fist, but they're going to invent a completely new supporting cast
right.
and a new love interest.
Yeah.
And like now they're like, what can we? It's not what can we throw out; it's what can we?
What can
keep?
We keep? Yeah. It's a complete paradigm shift, and I realize I should be used to it by now.
Yeah.
But I'm still pinching myself, and I hope I never get used to it.
Yeah.
I hope I never take it for granted how cool it
never
is.
Never stop pinching yourself, Randy.
Yes. That's there's a universe where I never stop pinching myself.
It's a weird one.
That's true. And there's like one where Blade Runner has the narration. There's one where you pinch yourself and it doesn't have it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's one where there's a Blade Runner pinching you, and that's a really
and that's
one.
Really weird. Yeah. There's one where Blade Runner
pinches. There's one where Deadpool is in the Blade Runner movie.
Yes, there's one where Deadpool is a Blade Runner and he pinches me every day. It's infinite universes. Okay, but anyway, they have cast their Colleen Wing, and it's Jessica Henwich, which is a name you probably don't know, but she played one of the Sand Snakes in Game of Thrones. And she played Jessica Pava, who is an X-Wing pilot. She's one of the...
In the
Force Awakens.
She's on the Black Squadron.
She's one of the Black Squadron. She's in this week's Poe Dameron comic, actually.
She makes an appearance.
So here's the weird thing. I don't know why... I'd never realized that Colleen Wing was supposed to be Asian. I mean, she's a samurai. Her last name is Wing. It had never occurred to me that she was Asian.
I don't think she usually is drawn that way, or at least not that I've never
I don't think she is, but I think she's
doesn't
meant
she have,
to be.
Doesn't she? She to me, she looked like Caucasian with red hair.
I thought she was a white girl.
I can imagine that Claremont, in writing it, especially as was the style of the... attempt of racial diversity in comics in those days was to kind of very slowly edge her way in.
Yeah.
So if she had something like Japanese ancestry in the mix, I could see that. But do we know? Was she? Are you sure she was?
Maybe she wasn't. But if so, at any rate, Marvel is severely lacking in Asian characters, and this is a natural one to cast an Asian actress who, especially, is a really good actress.
So this actress is Asian.
She's Asian.
Okay.
Yes. But
yeah, Colleen Wing, I feel like is a character you can play around with.
Colleen Wing is a modern day samurai.
Yeah.
It is crazy to me that character is going to be on TV. And also, by the way, Misty Knight, if they do Misty Knight even remotely like she is, has a bionic arm and is a cop.
Yeah.
And then she becomes partners with a modern day samurai and they become private investigators. Okay. If any of that happens.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be. What's the guy equivalent of squeeing at the screen?
According to Jose, it's scree.
Oh, scree. Okay.
Scree!
All right. Fair enough. Because I cannot. I'm looking forward to Luke Cage.
Those
I'm very much looking forward to Luke Cage.
Those things also sound like they could come through very campy. And what's interesting is that the Netflix, of course, when
it
goes
to
their writers, it's not going to come out campy.
So I'm looking forward to Luke Cage, but I'm really excited about Iron Fist, especially because I saw mentioned in a couple of the synopses. They mention his iron fist. They mention the energy chi, you know, the chi and all that stuff.
I'm gonna sneak in here with a plug for the store and say we just got a rack that carries beanies.
Oh, yeah.
And speaking of which, you were wearing the Iron Fist beanie the other day.
Yep.
These are all – they're black or red, I believe, mostly.
Except for the Iron Fist one.
With the Iron Fist – what color is that?
It's green.
Okay, green. With the gold symbol or yellow symbol.
Yeah.
But they all have like the symbol of – and are they all DC? No, it's a mix.
It's a mix. There's Harley Quinn.
There's like X-Men, Nightwing, Harley Quinn.
Flash, Batman.
Yeah. They're super
X-Men,
cool,
yeah.
And you should all come buy them.
Yeah, they're $20. They're really awesome, and we just got them in, so come take a look.
If you check on our Facebook page, you can see you, me, and Tila modeling him because we them boys.
In what is one of our most shared pictures we've posted.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, boy.
People love that picture.
I should just make it my profile picture and just accept it.
But, we also got a bunch of new t-shirts from a new supplier, so a bunch of Marvel heavy
and
t-shirts.
And they're nice, too.
Yep.
It was one of those ones where it was kind of, like, fun to put them out because when we get that many kind of cool new designs, we all have to stop and stare, too.
Yep. All right. Also, speaking of TV, and I don't know if, Nick, you're up on this, but Echo Kellum, who's been playing, not Mr. Terrific, because they haven't called him that yet.
No, but...
Is
Michael
something? I don't know. The guy who is Mr. Terrific, Michael Sloan?
No,
it's Terry Sloan. I don't know. We're blanking on his name, and someone's yelling at their podcast right now.
Over there on Arrow is what you're
over
talking
there on Arrow.
About. The TV show Arrow.
He has been brought in. They did a different take on him where he's a genius, but he's sort of a goofball. He's got a little bit of Felicity in him.
Mm-hmm.
He's gay. Is he married? He's married.
He's married.
In the comics,
just got married.
I don't know a lot about Mr. Terrific, but. he seemed kind of to be like, you know, sort of GQ looks and kind of like a confident, like, businessman.
This is more the gay black male Felicity.
Interesting.
And it works really well. They did a great episode. I don't know if you saw this week's episode, Nick. It was great. I love them. They've sort of brought him on the team.
He helped that show.
Yeah. Yeah. He gives it a lightness. Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I've been screaming at that show the last couple of weeks.
But anyway, they promoted him to series regular, which makes me very happy.
Yes.
And I
think that's a great news.
I hope that he's going to be using the T-Spheres, and I hope they'll give him the code name Mr. Terrific, which I bet they will.
I bet they will.
So, very cool.
It probably should be Cisco in a crossover who names it.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Okay. So, let's talk about April Fool's.
Yep, favorite holiday of them all.
Yes, I love April Fool's so much in that
so much that you hate it?
It's so much.
But every once in a while, I believe, yeah.
I mean, I took a pledge this year.
The no prank pledge?
I took the no prank pledge.
Yes, that is, if you look at John Oliver's bit, John Oliver posted a video, which Dave posted to me last year, saying, I think he made this just for you.
Yes.
About how stupid and horrible April Fool's Day is.
Yeah.
And that's worth watching. It's one of his web exclusives. You can go to YouTube and watch that.
It's a great little 5-minute rant.
Yeah, in fact, I'll try to remember to put that on the show notes.
We're going to reference the handful of little April Fool's things we liked, though, right?
Yes. What I was going to say is that there are a few things that are always fun enough.
Real quick, Michael Holt.
Michael Holt, thank you.
That's Mr. Terrific.
But I mean, Think Geek is always good. Think Geek always does an ad for a thing that didn't exist. They wind up making
right.
And then
you never made that Lost Clock. I really wanted that Lost Clock.
What was the Lost Clock?
It was the one that you would
Countdown timer?
Yeah, the countdown timer.
Oh, if it made that sound when it recycled.
It would have been so cool.
The Tauntaun sleeping bag is the one famous, I remember. Yeah.
But this year, was it Canada? Was it the Canadian government? Was it actually the Canadian government? Man, they're so much cooler than us. They got Justin Trudeau as their prime minister. They got Putin. I'm going to move to Canada.
They have not Trump.
I'm going to move to Canada. Will everyone come to with Rogues Gallery if I just move it to Canada?
Yeah, we can just call it Canadian Rogues Gallery.
Canadian Rogues Gallery? Okay.
Everybody practice ANA.
Anyway, the Canadian government released...
Puck's Place.
Canadian government released Wolverine's records.
Which is great.
Yeah.
So I don't know all the details on this, Nick. What are the details on
this? It's like they declassified his... government-issued
I saw this floating around.
Records.
I did not know. It came through the Canadian government?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I saw this because...
I just thought it was like somebody did it.
I only saw this one because your wife, Suzanne, posted it. And I was like, this is amazing.
I saw there was a picture that showed like what looked like a kind of weathered typewritten sheet of like a work order or something like that for like a logging camp or something like from the 1870s, and it had James Howlett on it.
There
was a weathered picture of what's his name, Hugh Jackman, that looked really good. And
I mean, it's one of those things that you just kind of have to slow clap a little bit.
Yeah.
It was great.
Wow. I did not know that came from actual Canada.
That's pretty great.
They have to celebrate their most famous son.
I feel like they have had trouble appropriating him before because I think, you know, as famous as he is as for being Canadian, I feel like America's kind of stolen him.
I feel like if Detroit has a statue of RoboCop, I feel like Canada has to have a statue of Wolverine somewhere.
Probably they should.
They really, really should.
All right, we've been talking about the Faith comic, which Dave's been really enjoying, especially, and that's Valiant's Faith comic. And that is, of course, it's a miniseries. It's only 4 issues.
Yeah.
Good news, the response has been so good that it is going to be an ongoing series starting in July. So new number one, new jumping on point. If you have not checked it out, we have at least the first and third issue. I believe the second one is coming in a couple weeks, and we'll have all of it back in stock. So,
but we're seeing sort of a bit of an uptick with most things Valiant.
Yeah, so some interest in Valiant. So we've got a trade paperback section of their stuff. All their first volume trades are $10 a piece.
Yep.
And there's some fun stuff in there. So.
And I do feel like Faith was interesting to me. It's not because she's been on like one of the superhero team books.
Yeah.
But she's kind of trying to fly solo. But she's still kind of in connection with a few of those characters. You know. her ex-boyfriend is on a reality show, and he's one of the characters from there.
Yeah.
She talks to Archer from Archer and Armstrong. Is like, she's like his like Skype buddy, and they talk TV, nerdy stuff.
That makes sense.
And then there's villains and stuff that cross over from that. So I haven't read those books, but I'm enjoying kind of getting the slices of them through this, and it's making me want to check them out.
Yeah.
It sort of reminds me in a good way of, you know, that feeling you get when you pick up a Marvel or DC book, and you get some elements of the broader world, and you're like, it seems cool, but it's not annoying in that way that's like, oh, I have to go read those or I'm not going to understand it.
Right, right.
So, but yeah, I'm happy to hear that. That's really cool for Faith.
All right. There's also, they just announced a Ahsoka Tano novel.
Yes, and if you don't know who Ahsoka Tana is, she's the original
Jedi.
You're
a very bad person if you don't know.
That's true, you're a bad person.
She was the Padawan of Anakin Skywalker in the Clone Wars series. I believe in her early days, kind of looked on as the annoying sidekick.
Yeah, people did not like her early on because she had a little nickname for him. She called him Sky Guy. He called her Snips. It was all too cutesy.
Yep.
But very quickly became a beloved character. And then people were very worried about her because we've all seen the movies.
We know what happens to the Jedi.
Darth Vader does not have a fun-loving sidekick who comes in and is like, hey, Darth, remember I used to call you Sky Guy? Like, that doesn't happen anywhere in the movie. So the obvious assumption was something bad happened to Ahsoka Tano. If you're up on Rebels, and we'll talk about it a little later, she has come back.
Yep.
They made some sort of references, but they didn't actually say, like, what happened to her between the end of the Clone Wars and the beginning of the Rebels era? Well, this novel is called Ahsoka Tano, coming out October 11th by Star Wars fan E.K. Johnston. I don't know this guy at all. Is going to bridge the gap between what happened to her after the Clone Wars in Order 66 and before she was part of the Rebels team. So
I mean, it's an instant buy for me. I'm
interested.
I really do love the character. And it is weird because she did start off as that annoying one, but
she became pretty awesome pretty quick.
Yeah, it was just the character arc and the voice talent behind it, which I'm blanking on her name.
I don't remember her name either.
I have this feeling that probably, I know Lucas kept a hand in that series throughout it, but I think his fingerprints are more notably over, like, the first three episodes that became... like, the movie.
The movie.
Yeah, and, the movie. Oh.
And I don't think the movie's that bad, actually.
It has some bad elements.
Who's the Hutt?
Oh.
Gardula.
No.
No, Zero that was another one.
Zero the Hutt.
The one who was based...
Zero the Hutt is awful.
On...
Truman Capote.
Truman Capote, yes.
Zero the Hutt shows up later in the Clone Wars, and I almost had to turn off the TV. It's so bad.
But the rest of it's good. The rest of
the Clone Wars is good. I have not watched the movie, and I have been told by various sources that is the correct decision.
There's still some cool stuff in it.
There is some good stuff, but there's a lot of bad.
You know, there was a clip I saw in it. I think was what made me want to watch it, just because it was a cool action clip that showed. Those sort of six-legged proto-walkers that the Republic uses. There's a scene where they scale like an Imperial stronghold's wall, and they're like using some sort of, you know, gravity sort of things to hold onto the side, and they have like sort of a running battle that's between like them and like all these robots and stuff, or all the droids that are shooting down at them, which is a pretty badass fight.
Yeah. As an aside, my son loves the dark side. He likes the villains way better than the heroes, and a big part of that is that the bad guys have AT-ATs. So one of the things he's always wanted is like, why don't the Rebels have cool? So I think the Rebels should have repurposed those Republic tanks.
Yeah,
and then maybe they could have had my 8-year-old son as one of their allies.
I mean, it's not wrong. I mean, the villains are really cooler.
Well, you know they what? Are. Cobra has cool gear too.
Cobra has his tanks, and then
I like the Mobat. You know,
his
tanks are cooler. On the other hand, Cobra did G.I. Joe. I think that might have been one of the great innovations of the toy makers of the era. Is they did gear up G.I. Joe pretty well. The hovercraft,
that was cool. Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong, G.I. Joe's got some amazing. The Awestriker,
but there is something to say. You know, like the vamp is cool, but those Fang Cobra jeeps that are all black and
they're way cooler.
They look cooler.
They also have a missile rack.
Not the Fang. The Fang was the copter.
Copter. You're right. What do they call the?
What do they call their jeeps?
Right now, somebody is yelling at their.
I'm yelling at myself because.
Yep, you'd think we don't. One of us should recall it, but I can't recall it.
You
anyway.
Proceed, Randy, and I'm looking it up on my phone
because the asp is the watercraft.
The asp was like a gun emplacement. That they towed behind. This
oh, that's right.
It
was Water Moccasin was not the name of the vehicle. That was the pilot.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a rabbit hole. I'm not going down. Okay. All right. Back to the news. There's a new trailer for Overwatch. Another short called Alive that is a it focuses on one of the bad guys who I don't remember her name, and Tracer, who's like the British teleporting two-gun wielding. It's a little dark, actually. I was kind of surprised it was a little dark.
It involves a sort of a planned assassination.
Yeah,
and
but it's like a robot leader who is like a Martin Luther King type between robots and humans.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of implied backstory for what's
going on.
There's
some cool stuff in this world.
Well, you know, I think I told you it reminded me of the world, of course, of Disney or Pixar movie, Big Hero 6.
Big Hero 6, yeah, yeah.
You know, which is to say it was kind of a near, not far-flung future, but a near-ish superhero future.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of a little bit more of like, not superheroes in the traditional Marvel DC sense, but a little bit more in that Big Hero 6 kind of
tech-based
sense. Yeah.
I'm hoping to get a pre-order of this game for my birthday, which is coming up. I'm really looking forward to playing it, but I think I've liked these trailers more than you have, Dave. I think I've been more into the one-offs.
Yeah, I like them, but I think because I was spoiled by how I think maybe the comic timing of the what's that game? Team Fortress.
Yeah.
Those ones.
Yeah.
That these ones have not. They haven't quite hit the emotion that I would hope for from a sort of the slightly Pixar look to it, or quite the comic timing of Team Fortress. And so they're good. But I expected they would be a little bit
hard to beat Valve.
I'm really liking them, but I comparing them to the Team Fortress trailer, that's not fair. That is the high water mark.
The Cobra Jeep is the stinger.
The stinger.
Yeah.
Okay. all right. Finally, there's been a lot of videos released for The Killing Joke, the new animated movie that is coming out soon?
Adapting Alan Moore's famous graphic novel of the 80s.
It's Paul Dini involved? No.
Yes.
He is involved. He is. So Paul Dini.
I've only seen Bruce Timm.
Bruce Timm. I don't think Paul Dini's involved.
I believe that's right.
Okay. Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bruce Timm, which is actually kind of unfortunate because Dini and Timm together are great. Timm on his own and Dini on their own both have ticks that they don't compensate for as well.
Right. On the other hand, I can see why Dini might not want to be interested in this because it's essentially an adaptation of somebody else's work.
Yeah.
You know, just a slight expansion upon.
Yeah.
Or maybe big expansion.
Big expansion on. So, notable that it's got Bruce Timm from the animated series. Notable that it's got Kevin Conroy as Batman and Mark Hamill as the Joker. And notable that it is one of the most famous stories.
Now, I know there's like a 12-minute teaser. Is that a...
Yeah, it's almost...
behind the scenes
thing
that shows a lot of clips.
But they also talk to the director, Sam Liu.
I saw must have seen like at least a dozen little snippets that I like recognize every single scene that it's from. It's like, obviously here's the scene where Joker's playing solitaire in the opening sequence.
Yeah.
You know, here's the scene with the creepy little dwarf people in bondage gear.
They're going in on it. Yeah.
Yeah. It does look like, you know, as always with these things, a little action dub.
Yeah.
But even like the fight, they showed some blows being exchanged between Batman and the Joker. And I recognized them as the moves that were going on, like when they're fighting at the fairground near the end. I was like, those are the exact moves.
So I have to ask, because I didn't watch it, and that's just me being unprepared for this podcast. But is it anywhere near like Brian Boland style art?
It looks more standard animated. I mean, it echoes Boland stuff, but it doesn't have that painty style.
You know,
I mean, that's really hard to do.
Right, right. Or the sort of elaborate hatching and stuff.
I know that's sort of what they try to emulate a little bit of what the artist brought to the table.
There's certain anime artists I've seen that, like some of the guys who did like the Animatrix way back in the day, who do a sort of super detailed style that I could imagine emulating his look. But here, it's closer to, I would say, general DC animation standards, which is to say it looks good. It's not like the stylized, larger kind of figures of Bruce Timm. It does have this sort of leaner look of Boland stuff. But aside from the fact that the designs and stuff, like those little bondage dwarfs, they look like what he drew. But like, it didn't particularly emulate his style.
See, I have my problems with The Killing Joke as a story. I think
that's not unusual. A lot of people.
I find it a little rapey. I don't like that he basically sacrificed Barbara Gordon without any acknowledgement of her as a character. She was just a foil she was a plot device to motivate Gordon and Batman. And I think it's a weirdly anti-feminist message, I think, to send, and also just kind of a betrayal of a perfectly good character. Now, Ostrander picked up the pieces very well and made her Oracle, so I always Oracle, in retrospect, makes me like Killing Joke more.
Right. But that was kind of a lucky break. Yeah.
And also, Alan Moore's larger sort of point, which Dave was talking about earlier, we were mentioning off mic, the sort of meta nature of, is that this is Alan Moore saying, hey, look, nothing changes in superhero comics. Joker kills and Batman doesn't do anything about it. And it makes Batman look ineffectual or even cruel.
Yeah,
unless you view the Morrison take, in which he thinks he kills Joker at the end, which I don't think is the...
Well, since I think Boland outright... I was combining Moore and Boland.
Moland.
Moore wouldn't comment on it, I'm sure, at all. But yeah. Boland, I believe, outright refuted that.
Yeah.
That was never the intent. But I have to say, once I heard that Morrison theory, it does look like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like
the story either way has always struck me as at least reflecting in some way. This was because this story occurred, I think, right before Alan Moore left DC for some years, and he was frustrated with mainstream superhero comics. And I believe he was frustrated with the fact that they had a certain static quality, that was basically what they did. And actually, things have changed quite a bit now. You see longer running changes, but there's almost always still some reversion to status quo. And so I think he wanted to push Batman and see, you know, what would the character do, you know, would he break? And he wanted to show either that it would take him killing the Joker to break the cycle, or that he ends up still just taking him back to jail, essentially.
Yep.
Which does have this very grim kind of, I mean, I believe that's what the killing joke, the grim laughter was to me at the end, was the acknowledgement that they were locked in that cycle.
But the movie, it seems they're going to do a Batgirl story, and they're going to throw in some additional Batgirl material to sort of show her as a character. So that it isn't just something that happens to her because of Batman. They're like, there's going to be basically a prologue and a prequel, and I like that a lot.
I think as a sort of like, as a singular opus when it came out as a graphic novel originally,
it didn't
bother me, you know, that, you know, this was just a horrific thing the Joker did, but Batgirl wasn't really much done with her character.
Yeah.
But because the movies and stuff, they try to make them feel like they're part of a larger universe. And there it does make a lot more sense to kind of go ahead and bring her story into it. So I think that's a good call, too.
Yeah. I'll be curious to see.
The voices seem amazing, you know. Yep. Mark Hamill and Kevin Conroy are doing the voices. You'll see people talking behind the scenes. It looks very faithful, right down to, like, I saw the scene where Gordon's going past the monitors, and it has that creepy, as Randy noted, rapey vibe, because Joker undresses his daughter and takes pictures of her after he's shot her.
Mm-hmm.
And that looked to be represented in the movie, so it's definitely going to be probably the darkest DC movie to date.
Yeah, or at least up there. They've done some dark stuff.
Yeah, that's true. I heard Flashpoint was really dark.
Yeah. DC does dark stuff?
Exclusively, actually.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Except for Flash and Supergirl, which are freaking amazing.
Yes. There might be a lesson there. But that's for later, because Dave is going to give you his review of Batman vs. Superman when we get to topics. But before that, we got to talk about what is probably the best week of comics, and we'll be doing that in just a second. All right, I declare this to be the best week of comics of 2016.
And I don't agree with Randy often, but I agree with him.
we'll see. We're only into April, but this is a great week for comics.
Yeah.
There are so many things that could have been my pick this week. In fact, I think everything every one of us is picking, with one notable exception that I just haven't read yet, would have been a pick of mine. And I think that goes both ways for Nick and me. A lot
seven
of these
picks?
Yeah, right.
I mean, because I want seven picks.
Yeah. So let's get into it. Let's talk about what we like this week, and let's start with the gentleman who's not so sure this is the best week of comics this year.
Yeah,
and that's Dave.
Yeah, I found it to be a good week, but there weren't as many books that hit me this week as hit y'all. That said, I was super happy with Poe Dameron number one.
Yay!
Which, honestly, I was actually kind of not expecting to like. I was
thinking
that I would... Charles Soule, although I do really like his stuff in general, I wasn't sure how he's going to adapt to Star Wars. And Phil Noto is an artist who I admire from afar, but never works on projects I like. Ooh, so I'm kind of used to meh.
This is Soule's second outing in Star Wars?
Yeah, he did Chewbacca.
No, that was Jerry Duggan.
Lando. You're right.
He did Lando.
Which I need to finish reading, because I
Me
never
too.
Finished
never finished reading it either.
Anyway, this is a... this story is actually casting a little bit of light on the guy who began Force Awakens. The older guy played by the famous actor Max von Sydow.
Yep. Yeah.
Who everybody was like, why are they trying to contact him? Why would he know anything about Luke?
Yep.
What is his thing?
This is his backstory,
too. I'm not going to say too much about it, but it does reveal it in here. You completely find out what his deal is.
Yeah, I like that this is sort of a prequel to Force Awakens. And I'm like,
yep.
Yeah. Okay, more.
So in it, it's one of the things I liked is it, you know, begins in media res. He's on a mission. He's doing this cool thing where he's flying through these caves.
Yep.
He's got BB-8, who everybody loves, yep, rightly so. And then it sort of starts flashing back and showing the setup for the mission. And there's kind of a cool scene where he's talking to, was it General Leia?
General Organa. Point?
Yeah, General Leia Organa. And he's got a bit of the hotshot cocky attitude. He's like talking about how he's like, basically, they know that the First Order is trying to track down Luke.
Yeah.
And she has reason to believe for, anyway, I want to let people find that out on their own, but that her, that this guy, played the guy played by Max von Sydow, might know, and so the goal is, if they can find him.
It's a race.
If they can find him first, then they can keep the First Order from finding out about it. He's pretty cocky about it,
mm-hmm,
and she's like, you don't know how bad things can get.
Yeah.
What is she talking about?
She said you didn't grow up with the Empire.
Right. She's like, everything you learned about it, you learned secondhand. And by the way, I want to say, I feel like What's-His-Name really got his voice down for Poe. And I wasn't sure.
Oh, yeah, Charles Soule, yeah.
I wasn't sure, like, you know, if you could capture it, because he's got a combination of sort of cockiness, but it's kind of an infectious cockiness. Like,
and he's also a sensitive guy.
Right. It's, yeah, it's an interesting mix. And I feel like Soule really got it.
Yep.
So cut to a few pages later, and
that page made me so happy.
An awesome mission team to go with him, of characters. Are these all characters that we saw?
Black Squadron.
Yes, you will see the formation of Black Squadron.
Because one of the guys, is it Snap Wexley?
One is Greg Grunberg's character.
Greg Grunberg.
There's also Jess Pava, who we talked about earlier.
Yep.
There's also one of the alien dudes who we saw in a... We see him in a fighter cockpit in Force Awakens. They give him a backstory here. It's just like one line.
I love the middle guy, Lulo.
And then Lulo, who's an old Duros.
Right. Yes. They mentioned him having been at the...
Battle of Endor.
Second Death Star, yeah.
Black Squadron, by the way, remember how cool everybody thought Rogue Squadron was with Wedge? And this is like Rogue Squadron. Black Squadron is a thing. I love these guys.
Yeah. And then you move on to the search for him, which puts the I'll stop with the plot stuff here. But
yeah, I don't get told too much.
It puts them into an, it's sort of an interesting moral quandary of sort of having to gain trust and things like that, yep, as they're kind of on their search. But there's cool action going on. There's cool fighter pilot stuff.
The art's great.
Phil Noto's art is in fact great.
Well, I will say something that makes it even better is his likenesses to characters.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, Phil Noto has done amazing work, you know, just when he does sketches online and on his Tumblr and whatever things.
Yeah, in case people don't know him just by name, he did the Black Widow thing recently.
Yep. Not the new one, but the previous one.
And if you look at, Google him, and you'll see some amazing watercolored style painted artwork.
Yeah, he did a whole month of variant covers from Marvel.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten that.
A bunch of different things. But he does perfect likenesses. This looks like Oscar Isaac.
Without looking photo referenced in like that kind of painful way that sometimes artists do.
Greg Land.
I was always, you know, the Buffy comics when they started up. I was always like, I like them. But man, the likenesses.
Janty was not great.
Like sometimes you were like, I don't know whether that's supposed to be Willow or Anya or
Like, okay, that's Greg Grunberg. I know who that character's supposed to be.
Yeah. The likenesses are exceptionally good.
And that's really important with Poe Dameron, especially because people want sexy Oscar Isaac. That's a big part of Poe Dameron's appeal.
You get sexy Oscar Isaac.
I also want to say, in the intro, they call him, I love this, this is very Star Wars, Poe Dameron is referred to as the best pilot in the galaxy.
Yep.
Like there is no equivocating. There is one. Right. There is no one of my best men. This is he's the best pilot in the galaxy, and that's why they're recruited.
Star Wars thinks big.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and that's the bold swath that it cuts is part of what's fun about it.
The Last Jedi, the best pilot in the galaxy, the fastest smuggler in the galaxy. Like the people in Star Wars are cool heroes.
Right. It's for a galaxy that's as big as it is. It sometimes feels like it's a small town or like it's like an old Western place, and you have these reputations that can somehow go through the whole galaxy.
Yeah, the princess from a destroyed planet, the
farm boy with a destiny.
Yeah, it's big. Everybody's big archetypal characters. Yep.
Now, I have to say, on a slightly smaller scale, yes. there's a backup story at the end of this that was super cool.
Yep.
It's a story called Sabotage, and the B in Sabotage is a double B for BB-8.
Yep.
I feel like this is like one of the Pixar animations.
It's so good.
It's like a short. Yeah,
It's an adorable little short, sort of drawn by Chris Eliopoulos.
Yeah.
And it says with Jordi Belair.
Doing colors.
Okay. And if you know Chris Eliopoulos' style, it's very much sort of a Calvin and Hobbes-ish style.
Yeah.
And it's a little tale of star-crossed romance among X-Wing pilots with BB-8 in the mix.
Yep.
It's ridiculously adorable, making this first issue just to feel like an awesome package.
Yep.
You get a really cool serious story and a very adorable backup story.
Yep.
So, Poe Dameron number one. Read it.
Maybe as anticipated, if not more so than Poe Dameron number one this week, is my pick, Black Panther number one, by Genius Grant author Ta-Nehisi Coates, art by legendary Brian Stelfreeze, color by less legendary but equally impressive Laura Martin.
This book is, I heard, was like almost hitting some record
sales. It hit record sales numbers, and I am happy to report it's good. In fact, I would call it great. My history with Black Panther is that I haven't read a lot of his older stuff, but in the 90s, there was a late 90s, early 2000s, there was a run by Christopher Priest.
Maybe the most famous solo run, I'd say, the character had.
Although it was always struggling in sales. Like, it was a hard sell.
But I think this one was always critically acclaimed in that era.
But Priest tends to write sort of these, it was a mix of sort of West Wing a little bit. There was a little bit of politics to go with it. And a little
although
bit
it was
of,
coming out pre-West Wing, so.
Yeah, no, it was during the West Wing era.
Was it? Okay, yeah, late 90s.
Yeah. But it was very much a mix of sort of the politics and the notion of him being a world leader as well as a superhero, as well as being a black man and what that meant in America, whether or not he was from America.
Right.
And Ta-Nehisi Coates has picked up that baton. This is a guy, I wasn't sure. I knew he was a comics fan, but this guy definitely read and liked the Priest run because there's a lot of stuff. There's a couple notable references to Priest run in here. The supercomputer he uses and the Dora Milaje, which are a sort of the bodyguard brides of the Black Panther.
Yeah.
But also, he doesn't ignore other versions of Black
Panther. He makes reference
either.
To all the history of Black Panther. This is a guy, when you get a guy from outside the comics, there's always the worry that they're going to come in and do something they think has never been done before, but has been done 100 times before because they aren't really fans. But every so often you get a guy like this, or for that matter, Kevin Smith, a guy who knows his stuff.
Right.
And so this feels like Black Panther. It feels a part of what Black Panther has been. And it's basically Black Panther has been in sort of a rough place. His sister had taken over for him and was ruling the nation. She died. And I've not read those stories. I don't actually know what
that
happened.
Was,
it doesn't really matter.
That was during Jonathan Hickman's run.
It doesn't really matter.
No,
you don't
doesn't.
Need to know it. But there's strife.
He's in a rough place.
There's strife in the country. There's questions about whether Black Panther is suitable to be the king. There's someone fomenting rebellion. There are sort of loyal members of his cadre that are taking questionable actions. And all of this is built up in here as we start to build the main character and the supporting cast and all that kind of stuff. All of it depicted just beautifully by Brian Stelfreeze. If you've been actually awaiting Black Panther, you're going to be very happy with this. If you saw Black Panther in the Civil War trailer and you're like, oh, that character looks cool, I want to know more about him, you may be a little lost, to be quite honest, in this first issue, but there's enough here. Like, it's being like thrown in the deep end of a pool.
Yeah.
But I think that as it goes on, you will find that depth of character and story is going to really pay off.
I think you made a really good comparison when we were sitting out there sort of reading stuff. And you'd mentioned sort of Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely has that sort of infighting and sort of political backstabbing and that kind of stuff involved in this story.
Yeah, definitely.
So I feel like if you have any love of Game of Thrones, this is a perfect book to sort of jump in on because it is complex. It is challenging. But it has a lot of fun qualities to it, and I've never read anything by Ta-Nehisi Coates, but I'm probably going to seek it out based on this.
Yeah.
And the article that he wrote, he is a correspondent for The Atlantic.
Yeah.
And the thing he wrote on sort of why he wrote this way, this book this way, and how he sort of came to understand it and the character, he has a love of comics.
Yeah.
And it was interesting hearing him talk about how he... The differences between novels and comics are.
I'd like to read that article.
Approach to both of them.
There's also a text piece at the back of this that has some designs that Stelfreeze did. And it's an interview, Marvel.com interview with Brian Stelfreeze about what it was like to work on this character, what it was like to work with a guy who'd never done comics before. And the letters column is actually written by Ta-Nehisi Coates. He basically starts with saying, he's like, yeah, I've been doing this for 20 years. And he's like, this is surreal. He's like, I was a kid. I love comics. I spent unhealthy amount of time wondering what a no prize was. He's like, to be here decades later, helming a letters page is not just surreal. It's absurd. He's clearly, this is a guy who loves doing this. And that also earns a lot of points with me is right. that he respects the medium. He knows that this is not just a thing to do because he can.
Right.
Like he's not
just an idle dabbler.
No, he feels like this is something, this is like a childhood dream come true.
Yeah, because there's some people who come in and feel kind of elitist and like,
yeah.
I'm right. above this, but I'm going to write it and I'm going to deign to write
the
it.
The people who would come in and be like, I am going to come in and do comics like no one has done comics before. That is not the impression I get from Ta-Nehisi Coates.
No, not at all.
You know, Randy, you were talking about sort of the being thrown into the deep end a little bit. And I, there are definitely some times when I've really enjoyed that in my comics reading mm-hmm. career. Not like every time, but the 5 years later Legion run is one of those ones that I loved. And I was like almost bewildered when I first read that, but I so wanted to know more, and I became just like entranced by it.
Yeah.
So it can be really it can be interesting when that comes off. It's sort of something I like.
Yep.
Well, this is the first Black Panther book that I've actually read. I haven't read any of Priest Run, or if I did, I've read like an issue.
By the way, Priest Run, the third volume of his run, comes out this week in trade. Those are great, and I highly recommend them.
I'm just saying, this issue of Black Panther could have easily been my pick.
But I let it go to you, because much as I loved it, I think you laughed at every page of it.
But you're not going.
That's your backup pick.
That is my backup pick. But we'll get there.
So we'll get there. Because your pick is another thing that would have easily been my pick this week. Yeah. And that is...
This is Wonder Woman Earth 1, Volume 1.
A series that you posted about on Facebook and sold all our copies.
And sold all of our copies.
Yes, except we have more coming in.
Yes, Nick has done what we've never seen anyone do here, which is he hand-sold books we hadn't even seen yet.
Well, I mean... It's kind of easy when you can... Well, I don't know if it's easy when you just say a writer's name, but uh-huh. Grant Morrison is one of those writers that...
Didn't you, like, link to his interview or something like that?
No, I didn't, actually. I just said I was excited for it because Grant Morrison is probably my favorite writer.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. It's just that all of a sudden Nick had sold every copy we were getting, and now we're getting twice as many because we're getting a bunch later in the Wednesday afternoon.
But honestly, we've been talking about this thing for years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Morrison has done interviews for years, and... It just I didn't even pay attention to the invoice last week, and I saw that it was coming out on Saturday.
Yeah.
I got super excited for it because I've been really, really interested to see what he has to – what he could do with this world and with this character.
Yep.
And I actually didn't think I'd get a chance
to – Did we mention that it is Wonder Woman Earth 1?
I did.
I wasn't 100% sure we had said the name.
It is Wonder Woman Earth 1, Volume 1. Grant Morrison writing, Yannick Paquette on art,
and for those
and Nathan Fairbairn doing the art color.
For those who haven't read the Earth One series, they're a little bit like what Marvel did with their Ultimate line back in the early 2000s, except this is in the form of graphic novels.
Yeah.
Each one is kind of meant to like reinvent from the ground up Batman, then Superman, then Teen Titans. Superman, then Batman, then Teen Titans.
And now Wonder Woman.
And now Wonder Woman.
And they're not... they're not in continuity with one another, right? Isn't the impression that they're all standalone stories?
No, they're all standalone stories.
I don't think there's anything that I've seen in here that would refute, like, if they wanted to have the Batman of Earth 1 meet the Superman of Earth 1 or Wonder Woman, they could.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't seen anything that would make them not work, but they've never done crossovers yet.
No, not yet. But yeah, no, this is Morrison's ground-up take on Wonder Woman and the world of the Amazon.
It is one of the bolder rethinks I've seen.
It is.
Although Brian Azzarello's, to be fair, was pretty out there, too.
Yeah. It is, but this is sort of, from page one, sort of a kind of remake of the Amazons and sort of why they sort of throw off their shackles and become sort of this peaceful nation of women and sort of seclude themselves from everyone. It is...
Some of the darker backstories that there has been... I mean, that was touched on in, say, Perez's version, and I think, Randy, you were the one who was saying earlier, this does incorporate elements from, like, all eras of Wonder Woman, including things that have kind of been forgotten from, the Golden and Silver Age, but the stuff with, like, Hercules back in, sort of mythological times had, you know, attempting to subjugate the Amazons.
That sort of Hippolyta rising up and sort of taking back their...
That was that did not occur that way in Perez's run, but it was an element. It was almost like they sort of conquered the Amazons and then sort of came to, later on, I think, like, sort of respect them, or... I forget what it was, but it did not happen this way.
No, this is very much a take of man's world has been utterly rejected.
Yes, yeah. Completely. And, yeah, it's beautifully rendered by Yannick Paquette.
Yep.
And I think it's easy to say that this is probably the best work that Yannick Paquette has done.
Yeah.
I think so.
It's just stunning.
Just what I've seen. I haven't read it all the way through, but what I saw, definitely.
And then from that sort of prologue comes sort of this peaceful nation of Themyscira or...
just Paradise Island. They didn't use Themyscira.
Yeah, no, they didn't, right? They just did Paradise Island. And it's sort of the advancement of it. So Morrison gets to do a lot of world building.
Yep.
It's not just like sort of a, doesn't look like temples and stuff. There's futuristic stuff.
Oh, yeah,
they have sky motorcycles.
They have sky motorcycles. All felt thought out.
It's a paradise.
It is paradise.
They're all immortal, I believe, right?
They are. They have the Fountain of Youth.
Yes, they're all immortal women. They live in this world of perfect technology, of this sort of,
and it's like a blend of fusion of, like, you know, beautiful landscapes, but also technological elements.
Yeah, well, and this sort of peaceful culture.
Yeah.
But it also has, like, a warrior element to it. It's a really interesting world that he's built up for Rome to come from.
Yeah, and Morrison also utilizes sort of, you know, the molded from clay aspect for Diana.
Yep.
The page you're flipping to is, of course, shows the S&M undertones.
That's
throughout.
It's throughout, and it's actually handled quite well. It's not sort of like,
He didn't want to just be lurid with it. The interviews I read, he wanted to explore.
There's an aspect that it regards to their way of upbringing and their sort of their. Just them. That's just what they do.
The bondage elements. The sort of it ties into sort of modern BDSM culture and sort of consensual. Yeah,
willing to give up power.
Yeah,
and it's thereby like taking power from doing.
Yeah,
that.
The consensual nature of BDSM. It's which, really fascinating.
Yes, if by chance that's freaking you out completely to hear in relation to Wonder Woman. I think most people know at this point that the guy who invented her was kind of a proto kinkster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moulton Marston.
And also importantly, it's moderate. This is not a kind of thing where if you're a kid, it's going to go right over your head.
Yeah.
If you're a teenager reading this book, it's going to go right over your head. But there's elements of it in there. You're like, oh, if you know the history of the character, it's sort of a nod, which is kind of cool.
Right.
There's an interesting take on the lasso of truth and what they use it for.
Yep. I mean, everything is so logically introduced and cool and interesting. And the same thing is true of what he does with Steve Trevor and Etta Candy, who's a fantastic supporting character.
Etta Candy is amazing in this. But,
you know, Etta Candy, traditionally plus-sized character.
Mm-hmm.
I think they somewhat slimmed her down a little bit in the Perez run, although not completely. She was she had a relationship with Stephen Trevor. Is that his name?
Steve Trevor.
Steve Trevor in the Perez run, which was pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah.
But here they do something completely different, and I haven't finished reading it, but it was a ton of fun.
Nick pegged it as, I believe, Rebel Wilson being an influence on it.
Yes.
But there's also panel layout and sort of the weaving of this, and that's because...
You're talking about Yannick Paquette's panel layout?
Panel layout, but it's also in regards to, you know, there's a reason for the panel layout, too, which is interesting. And
this is one of the most well-thought-out comics I've seen in a lot of ways, and it's also just...
It's also an exploration between Diana and Hippolyta, sort of mother and daughter relationships, and sort of trust... Racial relationships, you know, feminism. I mean, complex and it tackles a lot.
I haven't read, I only read a little bit of it, but what would you say is like the story here? What is the thrust of the kind of the plot?
It's a Wonder Woman origin story.
It's
Diana
finding herself.
No, I mean the basic plot. It's the plot. It's a man crashes on Paradise Island and Wonder Woman reacts to it. That's the story.
And ultimately finds herself in the outside
in man's
Paradise
world.
Island.
Yes.
Yeah. Man's world.
Yeah, there is all the sort of traditional elements that you would.
But
find.
It's not like Dr. Psycho attacks the island.
No,
something like that.
No, there is not a supervillain in this.
Okay.
Nope. But there is a story, there is a through line,
although I guess, now that I think about it, there is a monster. There is a supervillain to some extent,
There, I mean,
is the monster the human heart?
No.
But, I mean, There's just so many cool things about this book.
It's also very... the vibe I got is that it's both approachable, but also boundary-pushing.
Yes.
Which is kind of what Morrison, at his best, sort of does.
Well, this is, to me, it is his... what I was hoping for him to do was basically do for Wonder Woman what he did for Superman and All-Star Superman. And this is not quite that.
It's darn
close,
but
it's close.
Though.
It's definitely my favorite Wonder Woman that I've ever read.
And I have a lot of fondness for the Perez run. Mainly, I think, due to Dave a little bit. I mean, I remember him being letting me borrow a first couple volumes or something, and I remember seeking him out on my own after that.
It's funny when I think back how far that goes, though. That was like the 80s to maybe early 90s.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're talking just like coming up on like 30 years.
30 years. It was 87.
That was, but like when it ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a dense read, and it's of its era at times, but it's still one of my favorite runs of Wonder Woman, but this in just one volume does a lot. I mean, it comes close.
I want volume 2 tomorrow.
Yeah. Morrison, can
we
have that?
How about in 2 years?
Yeah, yeah. That's the only downside is it's going to be a while before
I
get to the part.
Maybe in a year, depending on if they do an artist. Who might be.
And that's the thing. I mean, people want Wonder Woman books.
Yeah.
So I think sales on this are going to be...
This book is great, and everyone should buy it.
Between that and for all the controversy surrounding Batman versus Superman, there doesn't seem to be any much dissent that Wonder Woman is very coolly depicted.
Wonder Woman is awesome.
And so I think a solid to good version of Wonder Woman will do it. And I think DC, the same way Marvel realized that they had a huge thing with Deadpool to capitalize on, I actually think DC could do that with Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Maybe not to the ultra pop degree that Deadpool has saturated.
But maybe so. I mean, Wonder Woman is a character casual people love Wonder Woman.
It's crazy how popular she could be and how easy it is for people to embrace her.
Yep.
So, all right, let's do our other picks.
All right, so Nick.
I want to talk about my backup pick, and this is, in any other week, this would be Randy's pick.
Yes.
I mean, this is in a lot of ways tailor-made for him.
Yes.
But, yes, we're going to be talking about The Fix number 1.
Image Comics.
From Image Comics, written by Nick Spencer, drawn by Steve Lieber.
Nick.
Basically the Superior Foes of Spider-Man team.
Right?
Yep.
I don't know if I've ever heard you react as strongly to any comic in all the years I've known you.
No.
You mean me sitting at the table laughing my head off?
For like 20 minutes straight.
Yeah. Every page. That's ultimately why I gave up this pick in favor of my secondary pick, because I'm like, oh, I love this book, but Nick may have loved it more than me.
I think I may have. And that's, I don't want to spoil, because a lot of it is just kind of, you have to experience
it. But it's a couple of hapless crooks.
It's hapless crooks. Trying to just survive in an age where
old school crook methods have changed.
Exactly.
Much, like, things have gone online. If you're a smash and grab guy, it's not easy.
And I don't know. Nick Spencer is usually a guy who doesn't connect with me, but man, something works and
it's hilariously funny.
Yes.
It's beautifully drawn. Nick, you probably compared it to Shane Black.
Yeah, and that's where sort of it kind of came down with it. It does emulate a lot of feel of it.
Like, so specifically, like a movie, I'm thinking like
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or Iron Man 3, which I just finished watching again. No, it's very much Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. The sort of relationship between the two hapless thieves is fantastic.
Yeah,
they just kind of are dumb.
Yeah, you mix like Shane Black and Elmore Leonard a little bit.
Yeah,
this is.
I'm kind of scrounging because I don't want to reveal too much.
Yeah, you don't want to give too much away, but just if that sounds good to you, you should give it a shot. And if it doesn't sound good to you, you should still give it a shot, because this is easily going to be one of my favorite books of the year. I can tell.
It's laugh out loud funny. I don't think you could pick a better artist that can draw the jokes that you need.
Yeah,
because Steve Lieber is amazing, but he punctuates the jokes in such a way that that makes me laugh.
Well, and it's not just a goofy comic either.
There's actual full-on story.
It's got some great stories. It's got some great sort of crimey. If you like sort of crime stories, it's gonna get that.
Well,
but it's
also what friendship and and about a guy's need to get as much out of life with doing as very little as possible.
These are clearly amoral people from what I've read. Or immoral.
Immoral, not amoral.
And in the same way that crime writers like Elmore Leonard kind of embrace that without sort of casting judgment, seems to be what this book is doing.
Yeah.
Yes. It made me laugh the most I have at a comic book in years.
Yep.
So
this was a great first issue and one of the best new comics to come along this year. Dave, what is your pick?
I also have a humorous book, which is rare for me.
Yeah, I know.
I there's not a lot of stuff that connects with me on a humor level like that. And this was a ridiculous comic called Grizzly Shark.
Yep.
Number one from Image Comics. It's sort of a one-man show by Ryan Ottley, who probably most people know as the artist on Invincible,
yep,
right?
Yeah.
So he's a very talented artist, but this is him in sort of a more humorous vein. You really have to when your story is called Grizzly Shark. there is a sort of heightened, absurd, goriness level. It's not just like sort of the... It is a little bit like Sharknado-ish type craziness. But there's a kind of absurdity level that goes beyond that even. And I'll give you an example. In the beginning, a dad and his son are out camping. And dad is worried about sharks in the woods.
Sure.
It's just taken as a given. Uh-huh. There could be sharks around.
Never know.
The very next page, the shark bites his son in half. And the dad is like, he's like, as the shark is like eating his lower half, he's like, damn it, Donnie, move aside so I can get a clear shot with the shotgun. And he's like, I'm trying to. He manages to fend off the shark. And the son, who is now just an upper torso, will go on to survive through the whole comic. Dad takes him and drops him into the campfire to cauterize his lower half.
Sure, because that'd work.
And gives him a bottle of aspirin to sort of man up and take it, and he does. Then he they notice that his innards are lying off to the side, and they both share a laugh over it.
It is,
so
that about tells you what you expect from Grizzly Shark.
Ridiculous, yes.
It's ridiculous, but it's also a lot. It's very fun.
Yeah. Otley has a better sense of comic timing than I ever knew. His physical gags are very well timed. His characters are funny and his dialogue is funny. There's some people who are out hunting the shark too, and a lot of sort of visual humor. Definitely the most ridiculous comic I'm probably going to read this year, but it had me amused throughout. I kind of kept expecting it to fall apart, and I kept enjoying it on every page.
There's even a montage scene.
Yes, there's a gory, gory montage scene.
This is one of those books, by the way, we didn't know what to expect from, so I don't think we ordered very many of. We'll probably reorder it next week.
I would imagine we'll sell out tomorrow.
We'll probably sell out pretty early.
Because Dave will hand sell it, I'll hand sell it. Because I was very much amused by it as well.
You must know the secret. Grizzly Shark. That's my pick. Randy, what's your
right.
follow-up?
My next pick is not ridiculous. It is, in fact, Mark Miller returning to Marvel for their creator-owned line, Icon.
From Marvel. I thought it was from Image.
Nope, it is Marvel's Icon line. I believe because Stuart Immonen is probably Marvel exclusive right now.
Oh, okay.
Stuart Immonen is the artist. This is called Empress, and the basic pitch of this is that it's about a woman who is the wife and empress of this sort of monstrous emperor of an alien empire.
It's like a prehistoric empire. Right?
Yeah. It starts with a 65 million years ago. It's on prehistoric Earth.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like there was a secret civilization that rose, sort of like the Conans, Hyperboreans, and like that.
Or like Star Wars, for that matter.
But it does happen to be during, it looks like, dinosaur times.
Yep, there are dinosaurs. but anyway, she realizes her husband is a crazy psychopath and decides that she needs to get her children out of there so they're not raised in this world. And her royal bodyguard, who's a badass, takes her to get off this world. So they steal a ship, and they're trying to get away from her husband.
What I saw of it reminded me, and I'm behind on Game of Thrones too, but of Daenerys and her guy who's like her...
I know you're talking the knight, the betrayed knight, yeah.
Yeah.
This has some really great action.
It does.
It's a big escape sequence. If you liked Black Widow number one and what that did, this is like that, but with the different emotional stakes.
There is a little bit more of what I saw of it, like a little more story going on, especially, I mean, you know, Black Widow was very much a full chase sequence.
Yeah.
But here, well, it's weird. It's interesting to see a princess who is definitively a mother.
Yeah.
She sort of struck me, you know, if this was kind of a Ming the Merciless story,
yeah.
Usually, I'm trying to think. The Princess Aura.
Yeah.
And she's not a princess. She's not Empress.
She's not Dale. She's a woman, and they get to it that she was basically, she was one of the, like, she worked on the Pleasure Planet as a waitress.
Yep.
And she met the Emperor in his early days, and he was like, "You're going to be my wife now." And
at
she
time,
went along
it
with
seems
it.
Like she was kind of, it was, she was young and it was exciting, and she decides to run with it.
Yep.
And then realizes she's made some horrible choices.
Yep.
If you were to look for sort of a metaphor or something in this, this could probably vouch for anybody who, in their early 20s or late teens, made some dumb choices and realized they needed to rescue themselves.
Well, and it's also about abusive relationships. It's the getting your kids out of an abusive relationship that you were you had sort of settled into.
It's just that it has laser guns and dinosaurs.
It's just
that it has
laser guns and dinosaurs. If you liked what he did in Starlight, and you should because it's really good, you will like Empress.
Yeah, I'm on a new Mark Miller kick, and I don't think I'd ever would have thought I'd say
he shifted gears. He shifted gears to a more optimistic mode. It started really, especially with Starlight, but then Huck is really great, and Empress is off to a good start. So his need to do shock value seems to have faded a bit as he gets a little older and a little wiser, and I hope that stays, because without the shock value, Millar turns out to be a pretty good writer.
And it's also just he's working with artists that are amazing.
He always works with great artists. He's always worked with good artists.
I mean, what he did on Star Wars was fantastic. Here he gets to have a little more free reign because he can design the ships.
Yep.
He can design the sort of weaponry and all the other stuff. He gets to draw dinosaurs.
There are spaceships versus dinosaurs.
Didn't Stuart Eminem do shock rockets back in the day?
Yes, he did.
He can do some really cool stuff that, you know, seems like it shows the influence of Star Wars and also mecha stuff from anime.
Yep.
Well, at the same time, at no point will you say, like, this is a knockoff of something.
Right.
No, he's really good.
He's very inventive.
All right. Also on the list this week, because this is a week where I could have had a number of other picks, Spider-Woman Alpha, which is a the first of a crossover between Spider-Woman, Spider-Gwen, and Silk, all favorite books of mine. This is interesting. It has an artist, Vanessa Del Rey, who we think was early on in Scarlet
first
Witch.
Scarlet Witch artist.
And I like her art. I'm not sure she was the perfect choice for this sort of buddy comedy-esque episode of all three Spider-Women going off to a day off on Earth 65, which is Spider-Gwen's Earth. But there's a twist as to who the villain is, which is kind of cool. And I'm curious to see where they go with that story. This was a weird one. Rough Riders number one from Aftershock. And I actually only have one of these on the shelf because I didn't know what it was. But we'll reorder if people want it. This is basically a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen kind of thing. It's set in 1898. Teddy Roosevelt is sort of a urban vigilante at night, helping people. And he is recruited by a group of billionaires made up of Andrew Carnegie and who else? Let's see. Vanderbilt and Rockefeller, who he doesn't like any of them. But they recruit him because they need him. To run some kind of secret war. So he recruits boxer Jack Johnson. And you can tell from the cover, he is also going to recruit Harry Houdini, Annie Oakley, Thomas Edison, and whoever Mr. Eastman is. And I can't figure out who that one's supposed to be. Huh. But it's all these... It's basically, like I say, it's a League of Extraordinary. It's called Rough Riders. It's a team book. If you like, say, what Penny Dreadful's been doing, but want sort of a more science adventure than Supernatural... I would give this a look. It was a fun first issue, and I'm curious to see where they go from here.
If I'm not mistaken, Kodak, the film company, when it began, was Eastman
Kodak. That's probably who that is.
Been like a big inventor, maybe of like photographic plates and other stuff.
That's probably who that is.
Yeah.
They've all got steampunky looking guns, and it's gonna be fun. Oni has a new sort of all ages book called The Mighty Zodiac, which is a anthropomorphic animals. There is a stars fall to the earth, and this kung fu master sort of gathers up all these animals to go and find them before the evil rabbit ninjas find them. Really beautiful art by Corin Howell, written by longtime comic creator Jay Torres, who most notably did a lot of the Teen Titans Go comics. This is pretty fun. Black Widow number 2, which gives into the backstory of why all that action happened in backstory in Black Widow number 1. Also has Black Widow being a badass, and really just a great second issue. I'm really looking forward to more of this series. The Discipline number 2, which is weird and sexy and violent, and really digging this Image book, even though I'm not entirely sure where they're going with it. Two more parts of Standoff in Uncanny Avengers, which they did some really great stuff with Rogue especially, and her sort of her psychic conditioning that Xavier gave her, which is a fun little bit. The New Avengers, which has Marcus Toe on art, which is a huge improvement on what they had, and features American Kaiju, which is a super soldier who is a Godzilla, which is great.
That's ridiculous.
And then there's a new issue of Scarlet Witch with art by Javier Pulido, which is a mostly silent issue, which was interesting.
Yep. It specifically involves some monks who had taken a vow of silence, and so that's sort of part of the theme. Also, with art by Javier Pulido, anybody who's been missing him since his, Daredevil days, and She-Hulk, too, right?
This is another standalone Scarlet Witch issue, which is really good. Also, you guys aren't going to believe me, but I have a Bendis book in my list this week.
What?
I know.
I seem to remember I picked an Iron Man one the other week, and you threw a little fit.
So at 4:57 p.m. on the 5th of April is the day that Randy has read a Bendis book. And I think, like...
Mark the day and time, yes. Spider-Man number 3, which I picked up only because Ms. Marvel is on the cover, and I really like what they've been doing with her and Nova and Miles Morales and New Avengers. This is a Miles Morales book. It's about his bossy grandma who's taking his... She's very old school. She's taking his phone, and she's getting on about his grades, which are all due to him being Spider-Man. And it's... How do you... You know, it's another one of those... How do you be Spider-Man when you have a dominating parent, which is something that Ms. Marvel knows something about. And it's a pretty fun little issue. And it also has a cute little bit with Hammerhead and Black Cat that I liked. So it's a good issue. Good issue of comics. I don't want to tell you.
Noted.
Graphic novel-wise, there's a book called Nameless City by Faith Erin Hicks that is a story of a... basically, a little girl and a little boy. One of them lives in the outer city and is sort of growing up in poverty. The other one is sort of training in the kung fu and the guard and is part of the, sort of their 1%. And it's about their different worlds. And
what is the setting for this?
It's an ancient city that's been conquered numerous times by various tribes.
Okay.
So it's here's the pitch. It's built in an ancient mountain pass. The city is forever being invaded by one nation or another, and every new master gives its new name. But for the natives, their home is the nameless city, and those who try to name it are forever outsiders.
Okay.
So the lead character is one of the outsiders, and the other character is a street smart rat. She's a native. She at first hates him, but then the two of them sort of strike up a friendship. It's very nice. It's very fun.
It's very beautiful looking, too.
It's color art by Faith Erin Hicks. It's also written by Faith Erin Hicks. And the colors by Jordi Belair. It's really, really good. It's got a quote from one of the creators of Avatar The Last Airbender. This was a really fun book. Volume 3 of the classic Suicide Squad run called Rogues, which I had to mention that. this is some great stuff. This has their rematch with
the Jihad.
And some political stuff going on in it, and
Randy, as you're flipping through it, I also think Luke McDonald's art, I think, hit its fruition here. I think it's some of his best stuff.
This is maybe my second favorite part of the run. Until you get later on in the run, they do lose the costumes and do the Phoenix Gambit stuff.
I do always enjoy, by the way, the weird characters who end up turning up. So I see Shade the Changing Man there, which was not the Vertigo Shade, but more of the weird Steve Ditko original Shade.
Yes,
I see Lashina, or what was she? What did she go by?
Duchess.
Yeah, who was like their, you know, 7 foot tall, muscle bound lady, Amazonian type.
Yep.
But like, she's like real butch and gun strapped and stuff like that. You would later find out she was one of like the like an amnesiac female fury from Apocalypse.
Dude, spoilers.
30 years old.
Yeah, people might be reading it for the first time now.
There's some cool stuff about it. Honestly, that one is more about like seeing what happens when that occurs.
First volume of Amazing Spider-Man since the relaunch. We've been loving this relaunch. This is all the Parker International stuff, all the Scorpio stuff, the Zodiac stuff.
Yeah, we've talked about so many of those single issues. It's good stuff. It's
great to have the collection.
A really good continuation of Slott's run.
And then the second hardcover of Ms. Marvel, which collects not only Ms. Marvel 12 through 19, but also an issue of S.H.I.E.L.D. and material from Amazing Spider-Man.
So that catches up the entire run, right?
This is everything from the original run before the All-New, All-Different relaunch, yes.
Yep.
So very cool. I always like these hardcovers. That is my giant stack of stuff. Dave, what else you got?
All right, I think you've covered most of it. I wanted to mention, though, that Babs Tarr, as a Batgirl 50, wraps up her run on it. Which I think she came on board in the 30-something, 30?
19, no. 29?
Okay, there? Anyway, she's been on a few years. You know, it's established her bona fides in the industry.
Yep.
And just sort of a shout out and a congratulations to her for the for the successful run and for kind of reinventing the character.
It's a great homage to her original cover.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. That's cool. Archie number 7 hits this week. This was very close to being in my picks. In the story going on right here, what's his name? Is it Reggie? Reggie the Jerk in Riverdale has gotten in tight with Veronica's father. And is trying to rat out Archie for all this stuff. So Archie is trying to find any method he can to subvert Reggie. Which leads him to Pops at the Soda Shop ends up being a... Is that the guy's name? Pops?
Yep, yep.
Having a surprisingly, potentially strong role in it. And he's a really fun character in this. I sort of did not really... Was not really expecting a lot from it. But as always, these issues of Archie always kind of surprise me with some of the directions they take. So that one was really good. There is a book that we got that's kind of... that's called Geek Parenting... This is sort of what I would call a bathroom book, a light bedroom nightstand kind of book.
Yep.
What it appears to be is sort of lessons in raising your kid, drawn from all the pop culture stuff. Let's see. The cover copy tells you puts it pretty well. What Joffrey, Jor-El, Maleficent, and the McFlys teach us about raising a family. And I think it's a series of like sort of just short, several page essays.
Yeah.
Joffrey's
a cautionary tale, by the way.
Yes. For instance, the one I just flipped to says, "Is this chapter's titled, Find an Alternate Universe Where You Don't Repeat Your Parents' Mistakes.
Yeah.
So I suppose that one's probably going to touch on, like, Back to the Future and other stuff like that, where, yeah, you from time travel stories, you take the try not to make these mistakes the first time and stuff like that. Anyway, it looks cool. I'm sure it's probably written with a good sense of humor, too. and speaking of... I am an aficionado of Mad Libs.
Yep.
I don't know if you know this. My brother and I have a specific technique we do with it, which is kind of the stuff you take in when you do the Mad Libs goes through a brutal editing process, and only the weirdest, strangest, best stuff will get through. And so I'm, of course, as a Star Trek fan, happy to get the Star Trek Mad Libs today. What I'm going to maybe do is if we can do one that's not completely – that's clean enough for airing is I will do one of these, possibly the one about the caring for your triple.
Yes.
And I'll bring it in next week for good times.
Oh, good. There's also the Mad Libs game that came out this week.
Oh, that's right. I don't even know how that works, but I'm going to guess dry erase Mad Libs and probably like – I bet you like pick favorite –
I think it's all phrases and stuff.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I need to look into that.
Nick?
I have a few things to add. So the 7th issue of Contest of Champions, which starts a new story arc.
Is that an ongoing?
Yeah, it's an ongoing.
I'd forgotten that. That's sort of like Injustice, one of those things that came out of a game and has kind of become its own.
Yep, but this has its own momentum. Some new challengers approach. The challengers in this one being the Ultimates.
Interesting.
So Black Panther, Captain Marvel, and all them are challenging Maestro. But it is also a book where you have Punisher 2099 talking to Night Thrasher, which is kind of cool. the 8th issue of Invincible Iron Man is notable this time because it gets a fun new banner which saying The Road to Civil War 2, which I can sort of see because there's some things in here.
Also, Spider-Man on the cover is yelling Spider-Man.
He's yelling Spider-Man. then I've got the 4th issue of Old Man Logan, which is notable because Logan goes up against Old Man Steve Rogers. And then there's these...
It's a geezer fight.
Old man fight.
Exactly.
Except, then, like, the toughest old man in all time.
And the 2nd issue of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
The book that should suck but doesn't.
No, actually, it is so much better than the show. But, no, I'm really enjoying what Kyle Higgins is bringing to the table. So, I never thought I would, but it's one of those things where...
It's
good.
It's not like dark and edgy?
I mean, it's got some darkness to it, but it just feels
a little
like,
bit more than the show, but not.
Yeah, but
we're not talking Superman Batman territory.
No, but it feels exactly. It's entertaining. There's more to it than I'd expect, and the art is wonderful. So I'm all for it.
All right, that is our super packed, extra long Best Week of Comics 2016 edition of comics. We'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about some movies and TV and games. All right, because I know you all want to know our opinions on this movie, Dave went and he had a choice to go see Zootopia or 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yep.
And he chose to see Batman vs. Superman.
Yep, and you see those crappy movies. People aren't asking me about those movies, Randy. They're asking me about this movie.
Yep, but I've seen those two and I haven't seen this movie. But Dave, real quick, what was your take on Batman vs. Superman?
As an overall thing, I would say not dissimilar to what Nick said last week, which was to say I'm not among the appalled crowd. I think now part of that, they're definitely, I think Dave of 10 years ago probably would have been among the appalled crowd. I've sort of mellowed as far as like I don't get super worked up over things, especially DC stuff for whatever reason. I think because I'm so used to seeing them reinterpreted. So here's what my thought is: if you run with the premise that this is a grim universe, it could almost fit in with the Injustice stuff. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Nightmare Dream sequence that we've seen figures of and stuff like that overtly references some stuff from Injustice. Mm-hmm. It is as if that is like a potential canonical, a possible alternate future. And there's a sort of weird Crisis on Infinite Earthsea warning about that, which is one of the things that leads Batman to be so concerned about Superman's sort of power level. Yeah, if you proceed forward from that this is a gloomy DC universe. I have no idea how they're going to use this to set up a Justice League movie because it seems morose. But I liked it okay as a movie. I followed its plot beats. I did not see the. I know some people have discussed like major editing problems and stuff like that, and I felt like although Zack Snyder is not exactly known for a subtle and nuanced hand, that at no point was I ever really confused as to what was going on, and I kind of liked some of the little character turns here and there within the scope of the movie. It has cool action and stuff like that. A very weird Excalibur call out. I think I told you about this. Yep. I can't say what it is sort of without revealing some stuff, something from the ending. But aside from the fact that you see it used to establish a timeline at the beginning because it's coming soon at the theater where the Waynes get gunned down. there is a scene from the ending of Excalibur that is overtly referenced in the ending of this. And I don't know why it is. Zack Snyder. I don't know. It's weird.
Sure.
It's a weird guy. Wonder Woman was cool, of course. People talked about that. I kind of liked how she was introduced. You know the actor? Who's the actress?
Gal Gadot? I thought it was Gal Gadot.
I
thought you said Gail.
No.
It's Gal, right?
Yeah. And you don't say
it's
Gadot.
A weird name. No, I think it's Gadot. I think he's right. It's okay. A weird pronunciation.
Okay, sure. Well, I don't know her visually by sight.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she's introduced in the movie is at somebody at one of Luther's parties, and she's like just sort of dressed in like sort of like an evening gown kind of thing, and she's clearly kind of up on something that Bruce is doing, and I was like, oh, this is one of Luther's people. This is maybe some new version of Mercy or something like that. So I actually was shocked. I was surprised. I was like, oh, crap, that's Wonder Woman. So they actually managed to surprise me, which maybe it's just because I don't know what that actress looks like.
No, Mercy was in there, too.
She was in there, yeah. But I just I thought it would be another one of his agents of some sort. And I kind of liked how some of the stuff in there led to the discovery of the other heroes. They managed to work this into the mega realistic universe that they're doing, which, you know what it struck me as? It feels a little bit more like JMS's Squadron Supreme or Supreme Power thing. Yeah. I don't know what else to say beyond that. I mean, on a very critical level, I feel like it's almost an anti-Superman movie. He definitely has not gotten it any better than he did in Man of Steel. And it almost feels like Luther, although he manipulates all these events so that these guys will end up trying to kill each other and everything, and I was pleased at least that it wasn't just that they innately hated each other.
Here's the thing, and it's small spoiler, whatever. Everyone's read everything about this film at this point.
If you wanted to see it, I bet you have.
And there's this, I think there's this weird character arc that we see for Superman,
uh-huh.
And it of his mom and dad sort of telling him to stay.
That he doesn't need to, he doesn't know the world anything.
He doesn't know the world anything.
We saw the trailers and all that.
And it's like, that's what he's been hit with his entire life, going forward. And sort of, at the end of Batman and Superman, he finally realizes it, that he has to be his own man.
Right.
And sort of comes the realization that he wants to be a superhero. He wants to save people.
Right.
He wants to be the better.
It's a weirdly long time to get there.
It's a weirdly long time to get there. He ultimately does.
It's also, when I look at, his presence brought the Krypton... He didn't bring the Kryptonians.
No.
But he's associated with that, sort of Holocaust.
Yep.
And then also Luther's machinations get a lot of innocent people killed in this.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes doing things that are traditionally the kind of things Superman stops. I'm thinking particularly of a bombing sequence.
Yeah.
And that one was, like the one where I was like, even I raised an eyebrow knowing this was going to be like the gloomiest film of all time. I was like, oh my God.
But he wasn't, I mean, as stupid as to say, he wasn't looking for it. He wasn't even expecting
it. Right, right. You can argue that the reason why it happened, I'm a little annoyed that
Superman hears what he wants to hear.
Nick, you did remind me that there was a sequence, a sort of montage of him doing Superman-y stuff.
Yeah,
sort of winning the world over.
There's also a training montage of Batman, which I love.
What was the training montage?
To get ready to fight Superman. He does this 2-minute montage.
It is almost a borderline, I'm going to say Rocky IV.
Yeah, it's very much
like
a Rocky
pulling IV. Chains.
Yeah, he's like...
It's manly things.
it's kind of hilarious in some regards. And I couldn't help
but it was
laugh.
Like he was like making like, you know, like the armor and like his kryptonite like fighting staff and all that stuff. But it was like he was like forging it like a blacksmith. Yes. Manly things.
I would like to thank you both for convincing me that I've made the right decision to never see this movie.
Oh, you're gonna see it. I'm gonna chain you down to a chair and
he
play
will
the
forge
Blu-ray.
The chain himself.
I'm gonna spin.
That's that's what it's gonna take.
Yeah, no, I can't really I would certainly not try and convince anyone to see it, and I completely get kind of
the
distaste for it. I just feel like if you're one of those folks who liked Watchmen, or kind of like darker superhero stuff, if you like Arrow over Flash and all that, then you're going to get something out of this movie.
Here's the
and there's actually some good emotional stuff in it.
Yeah, the weird thing is, comes in July? Is that when it's getting released on Blu-ray?
Yeah, July.
I'm curious about the R-rated version.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know what the 30 minutes more...
30 minutes? Wow.
Yeah, it's actually 30 minutes
more.
Well,
I know Jimmy Olsen gets capped in that in those 30 minutes somewhere.
He gets capped in this. He's just, I guess, identified in the other.
Yeah.
Nick, you did mention there's a scene in it that's kind of a good humanizing scene, even though they humanize Clark / Superman in sort of weird ways.
Yeah.
And if you know anything from like the trade papers, you know that Zack Snyder is looking to possibly adapt some Ayn Rand stuff.
Uh-huh.
And given her sort of her philosophy involving enlightened self-interest as an overall good for society, you can see why he maybe never wrapped his head around Superman's all-purpose altruism.
Oh,
and so he never. You will never in this see the Superman of the comics that you know.
I think the one character I was most sad about not being his sort of traditional DC counterpoint is Perry.
If Perry White seemed like a big loser, and I didn't like him in the first movie either.
No, he's even more of a loser here.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have super good, strong journalist integrity. He's more JJJ, like worried about paying the bills. And
yeah,
stuff
and
like
I
that.
Just, I feel like that it was wrong.
Yeah.
And I know
Randy, there's a subversion of just about every character in this.
I know.
But what I was leading to was something you said, which was a good humanizing scene where you see Clark and Lois clearly in a ongoing relationship.
Yeah.
He shows up at her place. She's in the tub and he just kind of walks in with like groceries and stuff. He's having a casual conversation. Clearly, if a modern romance, which is something you don't quite see with Superman too often, and at some point he does actually climb into the tub with her in fully clothed, but it's a cute cut scene between a couple, and it's I get what I liked about some of that stuff and some of those other scenes you see in there is that if you're going to take the kind of superficial maturity of like being more dark and violent elsewhere, I'm at least happy to see a little bit of character maturity with it too, and I felt like that was a reasonable way to show that with through Superman / Clark. So there you have it. Right?
Plus, Alfred was cool.
All right. Well, while you were seeing what if Superman was an Ayn Rand character, I was playing board games.
You're being a big baby.
I played two games this week. One of which is going to be at our International Tabletop Day, and that's Birds of a Feather. Which is a card game of bird watching. It's really quick to play, really quick to learn, and basically you're just like you're putting down cards every turn, and you're trying to collect like all of certain types of birds. It's a really fun game. I really enjoyed it, and it was reminding me of the one we talked about recently, Sushi Go.
Yeah,
where it's one of these games you can play between other games.
Right.
Like once you explain it, which takes about 5 minutes, it takes like 10 minutes to play. And it was really fun, and it's got really nice art. Even if you are not a bird watching aficionado, which I certainly am not, it's really fun. It combines the skills of bird watching and poker. The other game I played was Pandemic the Cure. I am a big Pandemic fan. We talked about Pandemic Legacy. I love the original game. The Cure is the dice-based version, and having now played it, it was really fun and really gets the tension of Pandemic.
When you were describing it to me, Randy,
yeah.
I was recalling how I played the Settlers of Catan dice game and mm-hmm. really enjoyed that. And even though it was a dice game with sort of pressure luck mechanics,
yeah.
it's still you. I felt pretty like it was doing a lot of this stuff I liked about Settlers of Catan. Only our game took half an hour instead of like 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of a quicker play version.
Chatty family,
but it's got a lot of the same mechanics of things are going well. Oh, we're all screwed.
Right.
The Pandemic does.
Was the terror of the outbreak
was a pretty easy to learn. And if you've played Pandemic, your skills from that translate into Pandemic the Cure in a way that makes it easy enough to learn, but you still like. Whereas in Pandemic, when you've played it a few times, you know where the outbreaks are going to be. Like, oh, okay, we need to watch out for this. We need to watch out for this. First time I'm playing the dice game, I'm like, I actually don't know what's going to happen here. We've got to react more than plan.
Right.
Which was interesting. We did win, but it was a very near thing. Right. I would say that's
I think Pandemic in some ways at its best is those near wins.
Yep.
Which is in some ways I think the only way one ever wins in
yeah.
Pandemic.
Yeah.
A near thing.
But it's really fun, and I definitely recommend the dice game version as an alternative to the regular Pandemic. Nick, you had also seen a movie this weekend.
Yeah, I did. I got a chance to go see Midnight Special.
Yeah.
The new...
Mike Nichols.
No, it's not Mike Nichols.
Some is Mike Nichols.
I don't think so.
Okay, well, I don't know. Whatever.
I'm blanking on the director's name, but...
You keep talking while somebody...
I'll look it up.
...looks it up.
I mean, and it's basically sort of focuses on a young child who has powers and sort of what, like, his parents will do for him, but also his involvement in sort of this weird cult and how they view him as...
What do you mean by powers?
Jeff Nichols.
He did, like, Sheltering Sky and a few other things. Powers in the sense that...
Not superhero powers.
No, he has the ability to, like... And I don't even say he has the ability, but he has a sort of blinding light that comes out of his eyes.
Okay.
He like, gives prophetic visions to people.
Okay.
Also, sort of, but it comes with a lot of downside. He can't go out in sunlight. It like, actually burns him.
It's kind of a drama?
It is a very drama, but it's also, it's a suspense drama
right.
in a lot of ways. But it sort of focuses on him and... his father getting him to a certain point. So it's also kind of a chase movie.
Okay.
But it's very... I don't want to say 70s pace, but it is kind of slower paced than
right,
I was
expecting.
Right,
sort of the more deliberate style of...
Yeah.
Of...
But the performances by Joel Edgerton, Michael Shannon, Kirsten Dunst, they're all fantastic.
Okay.
Adam Driver is in it, Kylo Ren.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a great sense of humor
throughout.
Sounds
like that's a good cast.
Yeah, and it's not, like, overt humor. It's very sort of sly and dry, but a lot of it really focuses on the father and son relationship and sort of what he's willing to do to make sure that his son is safe. And he's willing to risk everything, as any father would probably do for their son.
Not Pa Kent, actually.
Well, no. Yeah, there's that.
Hey, Pa Kent died for Clark's
but,
not
if you really
inconveniencing.
Think about it, this is Zod trying to save his son.
Right.
No, I like Michael Shannon. I've never found him to be the most amazing actor that a lot of people put him up on.
You haven't seen Boardwalk Empire.
No, I've seen parts of Boardwalk
Empire. Okay,
because
he's great in Boardwalk
Empire.
He is.
He's a fantastic actor.
You don't find him compelling?
But in this one, I did. I really bought it. He's kind of sublime at times, very low key, but it's got this kind of energy and sort of anxiousness and ferocity as well.
Sounds like a movie I might enjoy.
Yeah, and I thought the kid actor was good, and there were a lot of just sort of interesting aspects to this kind of low-grade sci-fi movie, because it's not, like, hugely overt, and it's showing off of the kid's abilities. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while it is, but it's... it's more about the subtleness of it, and I was very impressed with it. So I thought it was a good movie. I definitely think it's worth seeing.
All right. We had a few other possible topics, but I think we're going to scoot those out to next week because we spent so much time on news and comics this week. So we will wrap it up there, And until next time,
Yo Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.